stopped him from using it.
Isaac had it fixed.
I know.
Hazel turned.
You know? I fixed it.
When?
A couple years ago. I tried to fix it long before that, actually, when I was at Claremont. An engineering professor asked us to repair a broken machine for our final exam. The math thing wasn't working out, and I wanted to impress Isaac, I guess.
Her brother's expression soured, as it often did when he hit on the topic of mathematics.
I took the whole thing apart, but only made it worse, and almost failed the class. So, about 2 years ago, I thought I'd redeem myself.
After a pause, he asked,
"Why?"
"No, it's just... nothing." An idea was forming in her mind.
"I guess I've never really lived down those 4 years," he continued. "It only made things worse that my name was Severy. May as well have been Hawking or Kepler."
"Please, Eggs," she said, invoking her old nickname for him, chosen for the bratty reason that her brother disliked Eggs, and it vaguely rhymed with his name. "You have to be a genetic freak to be a Severy. A person has the same chances of being born a Bolshoi ballerina or an albino..."
"Not all mathematicians are freaks," he interrupted.
This was an old argument of his.
"Some just have a head start in life."
"Well, you've turned into a fine detective," she said, changing the subject. "Not to mention an excellent typewriter repairman. It works perfectly now."
He frowned. "So you were using it?"
"Oh," she said, stalling. "I was poking around his office and took it out to play with. Nostalgia, I guess."
"Anything else of interest?"
But his question seemed far away, muffled, because a more compelling question now demanded her attention. If Gregory fixed the typewriter years ago, why were there mistakes in Isaac's letter? The answer came to her in an instant, as if Isaac had whispered it into her ear. "Because the mistakes were intentional, my dear." Hazel tapped at her window urgently. "Can you pull over here? Bathroom break."
"We're blocks from the airport."
"I really have to go." Gregory sighed and cut across a lane. He pulled into a McDonald's parking lot while Hazel searched for Isaac's letter through the pockets of a ridiculous rolling bag that Bennett had given her, her initials stamped conspicuously across the front. Tucking the letter in her purse, she made her way to the overcooled McDonald's bathroom. She unfolded the note on top of a hand dryer, and with a pen, examined the lines carefully, underlining all words with redundant letters, including the stuttering comma. "Comma, comma, comma. The Côte d'Azur on pleasant of the shore." "The Côte d'Azur on pleasant of the shore," she muttered. It was almost a sentence, but it didn't sound like much of a clue or directive. Côte d'Azur, Coast of Blue, the French Riviera. She hoped he wasn't sending her on a European treasure hunt. He couldn't expect her to go jetting around digging holes along the Mediterranean. She tried rearranging the words. "On the shore of the pleasant Côte d'Azur." Hazel startled herself by setting off the hand dryer, and it was at that moment that something about the words clicked. A smile spread across her face, and she laughed out loud. She refolded the paper, slid it into her purse, and practically ran back to the car.
"Everything all right?" Gregory asked,
but she could see that his concern was forced, the muscles of his jaw working to contain his irritation.
"It's been like 15 minutes.
"I know.
Sorry."
She climbed in, rapidly thinking of an excuse not to get on that plane. She apologized and found herself saying that she'd left her wallet at the house. She would have to reschedule her flight.
"Brilliant. You have a ride tomorrow?"
"I'll figure something out. I'm really sorry." Gregory made several sharp turns until they were headed back north on La Cienega Boulevard. Hazel adopted the frustrated expression of a traveler who's just left her ID at home. But to herself, she silently recited the first line to one of her favorite books, F. Scott Fitzgerald's Tender is the Night, the first 8 words of which Isaac had planted in his note expressly for her to find. "On the pleasant shore of the French Riviera, about halfway between Marseille and the Italian border, stands a large, proud, rose-colored hotel." Almost immediately, her shiver of delight at having cracked her grandfather's puzzle turned to a small, quaking fear. Now that she could see Isaac was leading her somewhere, how could she let go of his hand? As they eased their way up the switchbacks of the canyon, their cousin Alex came into view, striding long-legged down the hill, cuffs in the dust, camera slung across his chest.
Is he looking to get hit? Gregory asked.
As if taking the hint, Alex turned toward a clearing between houses where a set of communal steps led to the bottom of the hill. Hazel rolled down her window. Shouldn't we stop?
Gregory hit the brakes just as Alex's head was about to vanish below the staircase.
Hazel called out to him, her voice tremulous and strange in her own ears. He spun around, and when he saw her, he smiled.
Hello, Hazel.
But as he approached the car and saw who was driving, his smile retreated.
Oh, hey, Gregory. We thought you'd left, Gregory said. Where is it you live again? France?
Alex didn't answer but said,
Did you hear what happened? Drew became very sick this afternoon.
Gregory pulled the parking brake.
Is she all right?
Yes, but Sybil was in hysterics.
I don't know the details, actually. I'm sure you'll hear all about it.
So you're leaving? Hazel asked.
Alex shifted his weight. About that. I'd prefer you didn't mention that you saw me on the road. I sort of slipped away after my mother arrived. Kind of horrible, I know, but we're not exactly close.
It looks a bit weird, you understand, my abandoning the family in a time of crisis and all that. Anyway, I'd appreciate it.
We didn't see you, Hazel agreed.
Alex looked at her for a steady moment, and she looked back. She had never liked beards on men, but Alex's didn't bother her. Maybe it was because he wasn't trying to make a statement, but looked as if he genuinely couldn't be bothered to shave. Gregory put the car into gear, signaling an end to the conversation, and before she had a chance to say goodbye, they were pulling away. Alex looked after them for a few seconds before spinning around and resuming his descent. As she watched him disappear in the side-view mirror, she had the feeling that if she were to see him again, it would be from this same angle, as if he were never in the process of arriving, but always heading off to somewhere far more important.
Doesn't he have a job? Asked Gregory.
He's a photographer, remember?
That's not a job. Maybe it used to be back when it was a real skill.
Her brother's sulkiness had clearly curdled into a bad mood. She wondered what he would make of Bennett's latest photo installation.
What's he doing at the house, anyway? Gregory added.
A squad car passed them on its way down the hill, and as they pulled up to the house, they found an ambulance in the drive.
Jesus, he said. Paramedics?
Words came back to Hazel from the letter. Three will die. I am the first. She felt shaky as she stepped from the car. In cool defiance of the crisis, the Severy twins stood on the grass with their rackets, attacking a fusillade of balls erupting from a mechanical nozzle. The machine had been a present from Isaac.
If you want to win at any one thing, Hazel remembered him saying, you must do that thing more times than anyone else. Winning is aggregation.
Had she also heard him say, death comes in threes? Or was she making that up? She and her brother stepped over the grass, ducking to avoid a stray ball. Their uncle was on the porch, leaning against a column and smoking a cigarette.
I didn't know Philip smoked, Hazel whispered.
Philip frowned deeply, regarding them with only a flicker of interest. It was a look Hazel had seen directed at her many times, as if his mind were in a place she couldn't possibly grasp. Still, she couldn't help being fond of him, even if it was in a distant, admiring sort of way. Ignoring their cousin's request, Gregory announced immediately,
We saw Alex on the road. He says Drew's sick.
Philip crushed out his cigarette on the railing and lit another.
She ate a poisonous seed, but not nearly enough of it. She threw it up and seems to be fine now. We're not thrilled the paramedics called the police. It only upset Sybil.
Procedure, I'm afraid, to protect the child, Gregory said.
I'm sure, but when they realized that a curious kid had merely taken plant identification a little too far, they left.
Hazel cast a glance at a nearby bush. It wasn't the castor bean, was it? Lily warned us about those.
No, thank God.
Philip's eyes widened for a second.
It was the Mirabilis californica, also known as the 4 o'clock plant. Which it seems, he looked at his watch, is the time now.
They followed their uncle to the living room, where Drew, looking flushed as if with fever, sat at a window seat bundled in blankets. A stuffed toy unicorn, its fur still factory white, was propped on the sill. Sybil, Jack, and Jane sat around her, while 2 paramedics conferred nearby. Though Alex had mentioned his mother was here, Hazel was still surprised to see Paige, who rarely made family appearances unless forced, on an ottoman in the corner, looking like she might bolt at any moment.
It was a speck, Grandma, Drew was saying. A speck of a speck of a speck.
I know, interrupted Jane, but a speck of poison is still poison, and you can't ever do that again.
Oh, don't let us all pretend she didn't know what she was doing, Paige muttered. She eats up the attention.
Either no one heard Hazel's aunt, or they chose to ignore her.
Well, Sybil said, Drew won't be reading any more Audubon guides until she's much older. But I still have the bird book, the girl said. There might be poisonous birds, how should I know?
Poisonous birds, Drew snorted, with fangs.
Well, she seems to be in good spirits, Philip said, crossing the room to tousle his granddaughter's hair. Although maybe if you gave her something to engage her mind instead of toy unicorns, she wouldn't go experimenting in the garden.
Please, Dad, not now, Sybil said.
Hazel stood mutely at the edge of the group. She was relieved Drew was all right, but mostly glad she had missed the worst of it. There was only so much Severy drama she could take in one trip. Besides, something about having all the family in one room, minus Isaac, made her feel decisively locked out, like a perpetual interloper. She was wondering if her brother felt the same when she turned to find him gone from the room. Her need to flee back to Seattle returned, but it was immediately followed by the invisible tug of Isaac asking her to stay. Or, rather, her grandfather pulling her toward a particular spot in the room. As the family continued to chatter among themselves, Hazel slipped to the opposite end of the room where a large imitation Honoré Daumier painting of Don Quixote hung. It had been a present from Isaac to his wife many years ago, on the day her Don Quixote translation had been published. He had chosen the famous vertical of the knight riding his bony white nag, his lance held skyward at a slight angle. Isaac had hung it in such a way so that the weapon pointed to a shelf of Lily's translations. It was the same bookshelf that held the vast majority of her grandparents' fiction library. Hazel climbed the stepladder, grateful that they had taken the trouble to alphabetize, and ran her finger along the spines. From a spot where a Fitzgerald volume should have been, she pulled a placeholder photo of teenage Philip and Tom. Shaggy hair, short shorts, both standing obediently at the edge of the Grand Canyon. The photo was most certainly an oversight on Isaac's part, as nearly all reminders of his younger son had been relegated to a box somewhere. She could hardly bear to look at Tom's face, and after reading the back, this side of paradise borrowed by... She returned the brothers to their place. She was heartened to find Tender as the Night a couple of spaces down. Tugging it from its spot, she noted that it was Scribner's facsimile of the original 1934 hardcover. In good shape, too, despite the fact that it was missing its original clamshell box. She had sold one just like it in her own store for a handsome price after buying it for pennies at an estate sale. Part of the charm of this printing was its slew of minor errors, most notably the extra Z in schizoid on page 199. Had Fitzgerald been similarly cursed with a disobedient typewriter? She flipped past the front matter to the first line of the first chapter. On the pleasant shore of the French Riviera. But there was nothing there to find. No scribble from her grandfather, no applause for her cleverness, or hint of what she was supposed to do next. Hazel fought back disappointment as she searched through the rest of the book, and found only a couple of impromptu bookmarks,
One, a scuffed gift card for the store Book Circus. The other, a Polaroid of Isaac listing all the prime numbers, 2 through 47, on a bathroom mirror in red marker. His head was turned from the camera, his reflected eyes smeared behind 29 and 31. Yet she could still sense his playful smile. As she stared at the image, she realized that what she really wanted to discover was not another clue, but a more personal message. She wanted him to reassure her, not just in this specific quest, but in her life. Don't worry. You are in the right place, doing the right thing. After taking one last look at the photo, she deferred to tradition and slipped it into the now empty space on the shelf. She was stepping down the ladder, book in hand, when Paige shouted,
"Looting his shelves already? How much do you think you'll fetch for that one?"
She laughed to let everyone know it was a joke, but it didn't sound like one to Hazel, who imagined throwing the volume at her aunt's head with such force that the woman would topple backward off her seat, eyes wide, limbs clutching the air.
$100, maybe more, Hazel shot back. That's where your Audubon book belongs, on a top shelf where your paws can't reach it, Jack told his daughter.
Drew sat up suddenly. Has anyone seen my new cousin, Alex?
A few eyes turned to Paige, but her mouth was drawn tight.
I heard he left, Philip said.
No!
Drew shouted, transforming quickly into the 5-year-old she was.
Alex, are you here?
Drew's sudden enthusiasm for a relative whom she hadn't known existed 3 days ago incited a round of laughter. Hazel started to back out of the room when her brother reappeared.
Did you find your wallet?
Yeah, I mean, I know where I left it.
Slipping into the kitchen before he could question her further, she stood at the counter, staring at the book in her hands, suddenly fearing a reversion to her former state of purposelessness. Could there, in fact, be a message from Isaac hidden somewhere in the novel, as there had been in the letter? Then again, weren't people always finding secret messages in the Bible, the Constitution, Shakespeare? Look hard enough for ciphered meaning and you'll find it? Hazel closed her eyes and riffled the pages with her thumb, as if the book were a deck of cards. It was an old trick of hers. Whenever she felt stuck, she would use any available book as a kind of oracle. It was a game, but one she played with a straight face. She stopped her thumb and let the volume fall open. She slid her finger down the left page, stopped, and opened her eyes, ready to take the given words as prophecy. But there were no words under her finger, only one of the many cross-hatched pencil illustrations scattered throughout the book. The image was so dramatic she almost laughed. A man lay dead on a train platform, his luggage piled around him. At the edge of the frame, an anonymous gloved hand gripped a still-smoking revolver. Chapter 8. The Other Severy. The next day, the sun shone garish and bright in a cloudless sky. From his car parked down the street, Gregory monitored the guests trickling out the front door of Hollywood's Harvard Hotel. As he watched dreary faces pass under a faded letter H, he thought back to Hazel's strange behavior the previous day. There had always been something slightly impulsive about his sister, as if she were obeying a set of irrational edicts given only to her. He wasn't entirely surprised, for instance, that she couldn't keep a business afloat. But yesterday she'd seemed particularly off, almost as if she sensed something was bothering him, and that the something was Tom. But even if she had somehow guessed, she could be alarmingly perceptive, it was true. She could never envision what Gregory might be planning. He returned his attention to the hotel, remembering something Fritz had said about one of Isaac's metaphors. The universe as massive computer, continuously determining its next moves. It had been Isaac's life ambition to tap into this computer, and Gregory imagined his grandfather's mathematics now calculating the entire rhythm of Los Angeles. Who would live? Who would fall ill? and who would step out the front door of a hotel and meet his demise? What if Isaac's universe-sized analogy was, in fact, a true description of how the world worked? Didn't this giant mainframe relieve the burden of calculation from the individual? If so, would Gregory ever be responsible for what he did next? The double doors of the hotel opened again, and two men emerged. The first was of no interest to him. Hispanic, inked barbed wire curling up his limbs. The second man was the object of Gregory's surveillance. Tidy in a white t-shirt and jeans, cloaked behind dark Wayfarer sunglasses. He gripped a small duffel which Gregory knew held gym clothes, a thermos, a waterlogged notebook, and a blue Bic pen. There would also be a plastic lunch sack and a migraine medication of fickle efficacy. The Harvard Hotel on Harvard Boulevard was not a hotel, of course, but a halfway house for former inmates. Like most residences of its kind, it maintained a low profile in order to keep families in the neighborhood from coalescing into pesky committees bent on their banishment. Criminals have to live somewhere. But why did Tom Severy have to live within 5 miles of Gregory's house? As he had done on the previous 5 days, he held his breath when Tom came into view. His former foster dad was pale and light-eyed, like Philip and Paige. And when blasted with the autumn sun, he squinted in the familiar way. He was remarkably toned, by Severy standards anyway, and his once emaciated body had a wiry compactness. The stress of a 20-year prison term, however, was apparent. His hair had gone white, and his skin clung red and tired to his face. His entire body pitched forward with a slight hitch to his stride. It wasn't quite a limp, but it was on its way. Gregory stepped from his car and into the shade of a ficus tree, though he needn't have worried about being seen. Tom's eyesight was terrible. Yet he couldn't rid himself of the idea that the man he had once called his father somehow detected his presence, was expecting him even. Tom had been wise enough not to make an appearance at his own father's funeral. Gregory had dutifully monitored the crowd that day, prepared for such an occurrence. And as far as he could figure, Tom had no way of knowing what he and Hazel currently looked like. Gregory was vigilant about keeping images of himself and his family off the internet. Even if Tom did notice that he was being watched or got close enough to make out his face, he would hardly recognize his one-time foster son. The last time they had seen each other had been in a courtroom. Gregory had just turned 12. Tom made his way east to the metro station at Hollywood and Western. Gregory tailed him into the tunnel below, and when Tom boarded the red line for downtown, Gregory chose a seat one car over. Given the immediate surroundings, he might have been in New York or London, except that the LA Metro felt oddly sanitary. There simply weren't enough freaks and foul smells to put it at the level of a thoroughly used rail system. At Pershing Square Station, Tom exited the train and emerged into the sun. His first stop was a nonprofit health club a few blocks from the station, where he would spend an hour on the second floor while Gregory waited at a deli across the street. Under his watch, Tom hadn't missed a day at this miserable little gym. Gregory supposed that aerobic and weight-bearing exercise was a carryover from prison, a healthy alternative perhaps to Tom's self-medicating of years past. After his workout, hair slick from the shower, Tom would walk a block to the central library. There he would make his way through the grand rotunda to the reference section, where he would pore over medical textbooks, face inches from the page, scribbling notes until closing. The 2 times Gregory had managed to walk behind Tom unnoticed, he caught sight of bizarre photographs, all varieties of screwdrivers and chopsticks being thrust into patients' eye sockets. Gregory wondered if it was the lobotomy's potential for pain alleviation that interested Tom. Had the pain really gotten to the point where an ice pick through the head was the only option left? But then if Gregory had found himself in the tiny minority of migraine sufferers for whom medication was useless, wouldn't he, too, fantasize about extreme prefrontal surgery? At the end of his studies, Tom would take the train back north, sometimes stopping off at a Ralph's grocery before returning to his room by curfew. As far as Gregory could make out, Tom was not looking for a job, and he didn't imagine that the gate check issued to him at Lancaster State Prison would last him very long. Would Tom eventually contact his brother or sister for money? Or would his pride win out? The only indication that Tom was conscious of money was his habit of peeking into trash bins along his route and tossing soda cans into a plastic sack. To keep the sack from filling up too quickly, he sometimes lined up the empties in front of the back wheels of an idling city bus. When the bus pulled away, he would crouch at the curb to collect his neatly flattened discs. Gregory often imagined, instead of crushed aluminum, Tom's flattened skull on the blacktop. Or Tom caught under a bus and dragged for miles, the asphalt flaying the skin from his body. Sometimes Gregory would wince at the brutality of his own imaginings. He would picture Isaac looking down on him, seeing in his omniscience the violent imagery in his grandson's head. But then Isaac would have to appreciate that these images were out of his control, that they possessed a weight and momentum all their own, like a steel ball gathering speed on a sharp grade. All Gregory could do was stand back and watch the physics in his head play out. It was already past noon when Gregory settled into a library carrel to keep an eye on Tom. He had just opened a coffee table book on lost L.A. landmarks when a text came through from the woman who was not his wife. "I need to see you." His glad heart thumped as he quickly replied, "When?" After he had stared at his phone for several minutes, waiting for her response, he looked back down at a double-page photo spread of the original Brown Derby on Wilshire Boulevard. The now-demolished restaurant had been built in the shape of a colossal bowler hat, and he wondered if he would forever associate this ridiculous building with the joyous anticipation he now felt. A second text came through, but this one spoiled his mood. It was from EJ asking where he'd been all morning. She was entering her mother hen mode at the office, monitoring detectives' comings and goings, and generally making herself a nuisance, as if she had already promoted herself to captain. He would have to continue his vigil another day. But just as Gregory stood up, he saw Tom close the book he was reading and stride in his direction. Panic coursed through him. He knows. There was a dormant need in him to meet Tom halfway, to wrest the Bic from his hand and jam it into an eye cavity and deeper into the tissue of his brain, until Tom screamed and stopped screaming. Because the man didn't deserve this untroubled post-prison retirement. He deserved upper-limit pain. He deserved to have cheap blue ink bleeding from his awful rabbit eyes. But Gregory remained in his seat and watched Tom head to a neighboring shelf. He let his body relax, and before Tom had a chance to turn around again and possibly get a good look at the person who had been following him for a solid week, Gregory collapsed the image of the Brown Derby and left the library. Chapter 9. The Secretary. On the morning of his advertised lecture, Philip woke with the image of a spiraled brain tumbling through his mind. He sat up, and when he was lucid enough to recall what the image signified, he remembered that he still needed to search his father's study. The drama yesterday with Drew had prevented him from conducting a thorough search. But now he had a more pressing worry. His lecture. The lecture in which he would reveal to his entire department his profound lack of new ideas. Perhaps he could dislodge some paltry insights from his mind before breakfast. But as he switched on a lamp and reached for a notebook from the night table, he felt a sudden pressure behind his left eye. It was a sensation that would start to unfurl and pulse, and within 20 minutes, if he didn't take his meds, it would feel as if his brain were being pushed through a juicer. He stood up, the resulting pain forcing him to grab hold of the headboard. "Jane?" But he knew Jane was gone. Having dropped the twins at school, she was likely on her morning run, a brutal course of murderous inclines that she enjoyed enough to repeat in the evenings. Philip sat for a moment and closed his eyes. His migraines were mostly on the livable end of the spectrum, essentially fierce headaches with the occasional flash of light that presaged the pain. Or, like today, the creeping sensation of a phantom hemorrhage. At least his brain responded to the triptans his doctor prescribed. He didn't suffer as his father had, or worse, his brother. Poor Tom, afflicted with the kind of pain that made you wish you were dead, the hallucinatory vomiting nail gun to the cortex kind, with medicine offering so little relief. A migraine specialist had once confided to Philip, "When it's really bad, and the treatments don't take, I've had patients try to kill themselves." It hadn't come to that for Tom, but it might as well have. Smoking yesterday had been a mistake. Philip had fallen back on his old ritual of purchasing a shiny red pack of Dunhills. It wasn't just the Drew episode that had rattled him, but the hostility coming from his daughter. His unfortunate comment about Drew's toy unicorn had later ruptured into a full-blown argument, though it was really a rerun of a quarrel they'd had before. Philip had tried to apologize, but Sybil made clear that she'd had enough of his and the entire family's superiority.
"So it's a cute little unicorn and not a chemistry set, so what? Not everything has to be super smart all the time," she had cried,
threatening to stay in Beechwood Canyon for the rest of their trip. Philip sighed. He would have to make things right with her before they left town. He needed his pills, but the only movement he could manage was to turn off the bedside lamp and lean back against the headboard. He would just rest a minute. In the dark, he could see one of Sybil's creations on the wall above the bureau. Broken Shoe Number 1. However much he disliked the piece, however much it conjured up the creaking meat rotisserie of his daughter's mind, for some reason he couldn't look away. Philip had little sense of how much time had passed when Jane appeared in the room. He could just make out her disciplined runner's figure against the light from the hall. She held out a single pill and a glass of water. "How long have you been sitting here?" He gulped it down.
"No idea."
He put down the glass and pushed his face into her stomach. The thought of pulling down her spandex was less a solid desire than the memory of desire. He was still able to enjoy her beauty and admire her graceful shape, but lately he found it difficult to locate his own lust. He wondered if anything was capable of inspiring strong feelings in him ever again. It was as if his work and sex drive were in collusion.
"Oh, I can't make your lecture today," she said, as she moved to the closet. "I promised I'd take Drew to the zoo."
"You don't have to come to my lectures, you know."
"I do like to keep up with what you're doing," she said faintly.
Philip knew that his wife's interest in his work had become generalized long ago. She still enjoyed the idea of it, still took pride in informing strangers that her husband was a hot-shot string theorist. But she no longer cared about the details. Maybe she sensed there was very little to know these days, because all his work worth knowing about had been completed more than a decade ago. He was now an aging professor whose best ideas were behind him, whose office was being eyed daily by younger and younger theorists. Intelligence fades, sex fades, the thrill fades. Where is all the wisdom that is supposed to compensate for the loss? But if his father's death had taught him anything, it was that there was no real wisdom with age. Only forced compliance. As Philip strode to the overhead projector to begin his talk on new non-perturbative results for non-BPS black hole M-brain constructions in M-theory, he took in the practically empty room. Putting on his best arch smile, he quipped,
"I hear John Britton is giving a lecture next door."
The small audience erupted in laughter, knowing full well that Britton, the closest the world currently had to an Albert Einstein, was ensconced in his turret office somewhere in Princeton. Whenever Philip heard the man's name, or uttered it himself, he would sink a little. It was hard enough to have an actual father you could let down without also having a string theory father to remind you that you weren't nearly as brilliant as you thought you were. In addition to Britton, there seemed to be a growing file of these monster minds, all shaking their heads in Philip's direction.
"You were such a clever boy. You were going to solve the mysteries of the universe, remember?"
Was that a German accent? Was his imagination really falling back on Einstein as a taunt?
Though it could just as easily have been Erwin Schrödinger or Werner Heisenberg.
Maybe this is where he would have his meltdown at last. Right here, at this decrepit overhead projector.
You should have seen it.
Professor Severy just sort of disintegrated in 151 Sloan. With the apparition of dead geniuses hovering, he took a deep breath and focused on the black hole mathematics scribbled in front of him. There was comfort in his black holes. These sinkholes in space-time were plentiful in the observable universe, commonplace even to astronomers. But for string theorists like him, they were precious hives of higher-dimensional objects, brains, that could help solve the quantum mysteries of the cosmos. After 10 minutes, he found a comfortable rhythm, glancing up once in a while between equations to catch his colleagues Kuchek and Kato scrunching their brows and taking spasmodic notes. The only person without a pen in hand was Anitka. She wore a tight, fuzzy peach sweater and watched him with a small smile that seemed to say, "Your determination is adorable, but you're making fatal assumptions. There's going to be a revolution, you'll see, and I'll be leading it." Maybe she was right, and this was just some giddy mathematical game they'd all agreed to play. Beautiful math signifying nothing. There were no follow-up questions, and after an uneven round of applause, the hall emptied. Philip left the room, expecting Anitka to jump him when he reached the door, but when he stepped into the hallway, he was greeted instead by a woman balancing on a towering pair of heels and gripping a shiny black case. Clearly not a student, though not faculty either. She crinkled her eyes in an attempt at a smile. "I apologize for barging in late like that."
"Quite all right, I didn't notice."
The woman's dark red hair spiraled to her shoulders, and she wore a slightly militaristic navy suit, the kind that made Philip imagine she had a dozen more like it in her closet at home. He saw that she was attractive in a pointy, secretarial sort of way, but she had blunted any middle-aged prettiness with a large pair of harlequin glasses. "It's fascinating, this idea that everything is made up of tiny vibrating strings of energy," she said, head pitched slightly to one side.
"Well, yes, that's what we're hoping to prove."
"Funny I didn't hear you say the word string once in there, just a lot about brains, brains, brains."
"I'll try better next time."
Philip was wondering if he was about to be suckered into explaining his work to an inquisitive dilettante when she stuck out her hand. "Nellie Stone, I work for Mr. Lyons."
"Lyons?" Caught off guard, he took her hand. "You work for P. Booth Lyons?"
"That's right. He sent me to make sure you received his note."
"Maybe he should have come himself."
She turned her head so that she eyed him through a single teardrop lens. "Mr. Lyons is very busy."
"Naturally."
"And he hates telephones. He prefers in-person introductions."
"Phone booth hates phones, huh?"
he said, but added quickly, "I didn't realize I had so little time to respond before he released the hounds." "Just one hound." She attempted a smile again, but it looked like a grimace.
"It's just that Lyons was very aggressive in trying to get a hold of my father, and now that my father's gone, I'm not looking to inherit your employer's enthusiastic attentions."
She produced a card from her case. "We're based back east, but we have feelers out here. I've written our California contact on the back, my direct line. Mr. Lyons would like you to join him for lunch on Sunday." Philip looked at the card, which featured their logo, the familiar brain spiral.
"I'm afraid I'm busy."
"I understand you don't work Sundays."
"I'm not a school teacher, Ms. Stone."
"I was only suggesting."
"And I don't plan on meeting your boss for lunch," he said, handing back the card. "If I did, it would be at my convenience."
"Keep it," she insisted. "Do what you like with it."
Philip slipped the card into his pocket. "Look, I know you're doing your job, but I'm not all that eager to meet someone who's looking to profit from my father's death."
"So you're saying there might be something to profit from?"
"That's not what I'm saying."
Her face relaxed for a moment, losing some of its sharpness. "I realize your father only just passed away, Mr. Severy, and I apologize for the graceless sense of urgency here, but—"
"Graceless is a good word."
"But Mr. Lyons would like to meet you for lunch, all the same.
after which you may cut off all contact. I should add that he has excellent taste in food. You won't be disappointed.
And can I ask what it is Mr. Lyons does?
Government Scholar Relations. It's on the card. Philip tried to keep a straight face.
Sounds a bit vague, doesn't it? Like the Institute for Progress or something.
I'm not familiar with that organization, but I'm sure Mr. Lyons can address all your concerns.
Still wanting a straight answer, Philip said, He's kind of intermediary then?
That's right.
She gave him a wink and neatly swiveled on one heel.
Hope to hear from you soon, Mr. Severy. Have a good night.
Philip was too annoyed to respond. It seemed yet another small humiliation that someone had come to his lecture only to seek out some phantom project from his departed father. As he watched her tip-tapping to the exit, he felt an intense craving for a cigarette and a martini. He was just thinking he might indulge in the latter without any serious repercussions when he turned around and saw Anitka standing there.
The Hayman Lounge was Philip's go-to watering hole, which, aside from the game room in the basement, was the only place on campus to get a real drink. The lounge occupied a single room on the Athenaeum Club's main floor, and was tastefully decorated with framed portraits of Caltech's Nobel laureates. Philip had long ago picked out the spot on the wall where he decided his own picture would appear, between physicist Richard Feynman and quark pioneer Murray Gell-Mann, and he habitually glanced at the space every time he entered the lounge. But one wins a Nobel Prize for measurable results, not pretty math. And it was going to be some years before a string theorist was invited to dine with the King of Sweden. The lounge was empty when Philip and Anitka sat down at the bar at 6:30. But within an hour the surrounding tables had filled with club members and a group of employees from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who were loudly discussing a NASA budget crunch. The more Philip drank, the louder the JPL people became. Anitka suggested they move to the quieter end of the bar. Philip agreed, though he tried not to look too disturbed with the intimacy of their new spot. He had spent the last hour trying to talk Anitka out of her anti-string crusade, warning her that she was on her way to career suicide with zero hope of a postdoc if she insisted on following her own underdeveloped theories instead of the one she had been trained to explore.
Keats was not a physicist, Philip,
she responded, using Philip's given name for the first time since he'd known her.
Beauty does not equal truth, and if we continue to operate in this mystical fairyland, we might as well jump right into bed with those intelligent design crazies, where they'll turn to us with their idiot grins and say, See? Told you it was magic.
Philip smiled, marveling at her certainty.
If you don't look at subatomic particles and see at least some magic there, at least a sense of wonder, then what are you doing here?
Magic?
Next you'll be using the term God particle. How many years have passed with no real results? Just a bunch of nerds going on about elegance. If string theorists continue to fail at producing experimentally measurable results, while at the same time discouraging rival theories, they'll soon be unworthy of the name scientist.
Philip had heard all of this before, of course. He didn't tell her that he'd been following an online forum devoted to discussion of her phony paper.
Where are your predictions? Where are your verifiable results? She had asked in one of the forum's threads. The replies were sneering. For a start, Ms. Durov, string theorists have already predicted something called gravity, so, there you go.
To which she responded, Oh, really? And what are you going to predict next? Heliocentrism? That the sun will rise at dawn? Next time you might try predicting something we haven't all agreed upon in advance. By his second martini, Anitka was still ranting.
Sometimes I think high-energy physics exists only to provide artists with existential metaphors, as if we're all here just to make a few shitty playwrights feel smart.
Philip wondered if she really was as reactionary and unromantic as she wanted everyone to believe.
You know what your thing is, Anitka?
She was leaning forward in such a way that told him they were both well on their way to getting drunk.
You lack the imagination for this stuff. Oh, is that what I'm lacking?
Okay, so your snow job with that journal showed a hell of a lot of imagination. But the hours you put into that silly paper could have been channeled into real mathematics.
Her face seemed to be getting closer by the minute. He looked down at his near-empty glass and signaled the bartender for another.
I'll say one last thing. You could be a great scientist if you would stop throwing rotten fruit at the rest of us and take an honest look at your own work.
His third martini appeared, and after a couple of swallows, something very strange happened. Something he instantly wished hadn't. Anitka blossomed right in front of him. It wasn't that he hadn't noticed her beauty before. Anitka's good looks were not purely a result of gin and vermouth. It was just that he had never bothered to look at her long enough to take her in.
She's a departmental irritant, remember? A pest.
She also tended to downplay her appearance by dressing in accordance with the sartorial rule of academia. The more subjective the discipline, the better the fashion sense. Or, to put it another way, the more poorly one dressed, the closer one was to the mathematics department. But tonight, with the peach sweater against her skin and her hair pulled from her face, she was indisputably radiant. Those smooth Slavic cheeks and large, languid eyes, and that Russian accent. A flower in the Siberian tundra.
Seriously, Philip, what is wrong with you?
As he strived to keep his eyes from straying below her neck, he had a sudden, insane thought, one that hadn't crossed his mind in 30 years of marriage. I could start a love affair right here and now. I could reignite my passion for life and beauty and science. And why not?
Because something has to change. Something has to restart this broken-down machine.
He longed to ask her, how does someone so beautiful get into theoretical physics? But Philip wasn't impaired enough to start asking such clumsy questions. And besides, he could guess the answer. Anitka had grown up in the Ukrainian countryside, where beautiful girls were everywhere, 6-foot goddesses hatching out of the ground like white turnips. And they weren't suffocated with praise as they are in the States. They weren't told from the age of 5 how lovely they were, because beauty had little value in a country where one was just trying to survive to the next week.
Isn't your wife expecting you for dinner?
He cleared his throat.
She doesn't really wait anymore.
He didn't mean for it to sound so pathetic.
I would wait.
Philip responded by folding a napkin into increasingly small triangles. Anitka alleviated the silence by opening the cocktail menu.
I want my next drink to be exotic. Should I get a Heisenberg highball?
Uncertain.
She hid her smile in the menu.
That is terrible. How about an Oppenheimer's Manhattan?
I've had that one. It's quite good.
No way. They make an Einstein on the beach.
As she rattled off a few more punny cocktails, Philip started to build a case in his mind for infidelity. There was, after all, a long history of scientific breakthroughs fueled by the intense combustion of this or that love affair. There was Robert Oppenheimer stealing away to see his lover, Jean Tatlock, one last time before leaving with his family for New Mexico to begin work on the atomic bomb. And Soviet physicist Lev Landau's steady extramarital activity as he labored on his theory of quantum liquids. Einstein's infidelities, of course, were lifelong and thoroughly documented, boring even in their transparency. Perhaps most spectacularly, there was Erwin Schrödinger, who, while married to his wife Anne-Marie, had one affair after another, each romantic intrigue corresponding to a vigorous period of output and discovery. Schrödinger had done his best work on his quantum wave equation in December 1925, during an extended stay in an alpine cabin with one mistress, whose identity still remains a mystery. The equation he had produced so feverishly between their lovemaking sessions would later win him the Nobel in physics. Schrödinger's good friend, the mathematician Hermann Weyl, who, incidentally, was back home fucking Schrödinger's wife during said stay in the mountain cabin, said of Schrödinger, he did his great work during a late erotic outburst in his life. A late erotic outburst.
That's what he needed. Philip's gaze settled for a moment on Dick Feynman's jaunty portrait across the room. A man who was remembered as much for his naughty, winking personality as for his physics. Even I, he seemed to be saying from his 8x10-inch prison, had a lifelong weakness for topless bars and Vegas showgirls. You think I moved to California for the academic prestige? No, it was the girls, Philip. The girls.
Do you want to share a 3 Mile Island iced tea? Anitka asked innocently.
I think I'm set.
How about a Bloody Marie Curie?
He stood abruptly. I have to go.
But we haven't gotten to my dissertation.
Yeah, well,
how will you get home?
I have a rocket ship outside.
Anitka burst out laughing, nearly falling off her chair.
Oh, God, how did we get so smashed?
She steadied herself by grabbing his arm. He looked at her hand.
I have a daughter your age, you know.
She slapped the top of the bar.
That's so funny, because I have a second cousin who's your age.
And with that, he grabbed his jacket and lurched out of the Hayman. On the considerable walk home, Philip would have heaps of time to think over all the stupid things he had said that evening.
I have a daughter your age? You can't say things like that to a woman you were going to have to see later in sober daylight. And why was he practically fleeing?
He wondered what Jane would think of his current 3-martini state. Or had it been 4? Just as he was calculating how much drunkenness he could walk off before he reached home, he noticed a car trailing him through the Athenaeum parking lot. This feeling of being followed so disturbed him that he flattened himself against a hedge to wait for the car to pass. When the dark sedan pulled alongside him and stopped, an irrational shudder of fear moved through him. The passenger side window slid down.
May I offer you a ride, Professor Severy?
A man asked from the driver's seat. The interior of the car was half in shadow, and Philip couldn't make out the driver's face.
Do I know you?
Miss Stone thought you'd like to be seen home.
Miss Stone?
The man wore a suit. Maybe a chauffeur's get-up.
I don't under...
The driver started to explain, but as he spoke, his accent seemed to thicken, and Philip was having a hard time making any sense of it. He was also feeling alarmingly pinned between car and shrub.
Sorry, he said, holding up a hand. I really don't know what you're saying. You'll excuse me.
He stepped through a serendipitous gap in the hedges, leapt onto the sidewalk, and headed swiftly in the general direction of his house. But the encounter, the whole night really, unsettled Philip deeply. And in the 45 minutes it took to walk home, he glanced behind him nearly a dozen times. Chapter 10. The Hotel. After the drama of Drew's encounter with the 4 o'clock plant had run its course, Hazel returned to her dubious scavenger hunt. She explained to the family that she wasn't quite ready to return to Seattle and the hassles of running her store, which was partly true. She tried to imagine walking into her shop the next morning, struggling to banter with customers while overdue notices collected daily on her counter. She imagined turning the store over to her employee, Chet, for the afternoon, asking him to tidy the displays or spruce up the store signage, knowing full well he'd just use her absence as an excuse to catch up on his reading. And why not? Wasn't that the whole point of working in a bookstore? She knew that Chet's reading wasn't just reading, but research for an unnameable book he'd been working on for ages, one she pretended not to notice he was writing. She'd then take a crisp walk to Bennett's design studio, but she could only envision unhappy scenarios. Bennett so absorbed in the lines of a swivel chair that he barely registered her arrival. Or worse, her boyfriend testing out a rocking chair love seat with that cute assistant designer, the one with the bangs and sparkly tights. Each pretending to evaluate the chair's merits, but secretly relishing their forced proximity to each other. And Hazel, standing there, stupidly gripping a bag of Bennett's favorite pastries. She didn't know why her mind insisted on imagining the worst, but the truth wasn't so much that she was afraid to go home,
It was that she couldn't rid herself of the idea that she now had a purpose in Los Angeles. She finally had a function among the Severys, and an obligation to the man who had rescued her and her brother so many years ago. Hazel spent much of the next 2 days holed up in Isaac's study, poring over his letter, certain that the text was key to revealing the place where he'd hidden his work. Perhaps somewhere in the house. Just in case, she called the Caltech math department to ask if there was a room 137 in their building. There wasn't. Maybe 137 wasn't an actual room, but a code pointing to the text of the letter. But any permutations she tried, anagrams, wordplay, both vertical and diagonal acrostics, evaporated into nonsense. Not for the first time, she searched the internet for a John Raspanti, but came up with the same results. There were several people with that name, none of them in the Los Angeles area, none of them with academic jobs, or even a tenuous connection to her grandfather, and certainly none wearing herringbone. After many hours of groping down blind alleys, Hazel returned to Tender is the Night, refusing to believe that her grandfather had been out of his mind. She had to keep looking. The gift card for the now-defunct book circus seemed to her irritatingly unhelpful. The Hollywood bookstore had gone bankrupt years ago, and its multi-storied complex now housed a combination gym and health food store. She quickly discarded the thought of haunting racquetball courts and bulk food aisles in search of camouflaged mathematics, and instead looked back through the novel. She scanned it several times but didn't notice anything unusual, other than an underlined word on the second page, literal, next to which was scribbled a definition in Isaac's hand, of or pertaining to the seashore. Hazel had probably looked up that very word when she'd first read the book back in college, though she hadn't retained its meaning. She scrambled the word for anagrams but could produce only tortilla and R.T. Lolita. She did the same for Raspanti's name, but after a few hop ninja rats and no Japan shirts, she gave up. A less nonsensical discovery came to her the second night as she lay in bed, weaving the gift card between her fingers and trying to recall Book Circus's motto. Run away with the circus? Send in the books? As the lamplight caught the store's clownish logo, she noticed that an edge was pulling away slightly from the black plastic. She went to her desk for a better look and realized that it was just a cheap sticker. She peeled it off to find a gold embossed script underneath. Hotel d'Antibes, 5819 Foothill Drive, Los Angeles. It wasn't a gift card at all, but a hotel key card. A large, proud, rose-colored hotel. Perhaps Isaac's allusion to Fitzgerald's first line was no literary coincidence. Is this where she would find room 137? Hazel would have shouted an exclamation had it not been for Sybil, Jack, and Drew sleeping downstairs. She considered throwing a coat over her pajamas and borrowing Isaac's Cadillac, but she knew the sputtering engine would wake them. Instead, she called Bennett, suddenly craving the sound of his voice. She wanted to hear him say that he missed her, that his dog missed her, that he discovered this new restaurant with devastating crab cakes, and when was she coming home already? But his voicemail answered. Hazel listened to his deep, unhurried greeting asking her to leave a message, and hung up. She couldn't sleep, and for the next hour she stared at the ceiling, pushing a swirl of negative thoughts about Seattle out of her mind. Instead, she tried to summon the constellations she and her brother had tried to create on their bedroom ceilings, using strings of white Christmas lights and a box of pins. An ambitious compensation for their city's lack of actual star cover. They had painted some of the bulbs black in order to get the intensity of each star just right, but succeeded only in making a mess. As her eyes eventually closed and she drifted toward sleep, Hazel imagined a reality in which their star project had been a success, instead of a childish tangle, in which those white string lights were still suspended from their bedroom ceilings, instead of having ended up in that bubbling water with Isaac. At 9 the next morning, after devouring a few pancakes left behind by Sybil and Jack, Hazel made the 5-minute drive from the canyon to a hotel just up the hill from Hollywood's Franklin Village. as she stepped from the Cadillac and squinted up at an imitation French chateau that was neither proud nor rose-colored. She tried to imagine what Isaac could possibly have been doing here, so close to his own house, with its blue mansard.